Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, April 17th, 2008. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. For this week, Michael Lally, head brewer for Chalk Beer in Krebs, Oklahoma, joins us to share some beers and share some tips on how to brew beers. Chalk Beer is the biggest brewery in Oklahoma. Steve Wilkes and I paid them a visit a few weeks ago. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. Well, the experiment with Twitter continues. I'm Basic Brewing on Twitter, and you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/basicbrewing. I still feel a little silly talking about Twitter and tweets and such as that, but I'm getting used to it and having fun. So far, most of what I've posted has been about my my poor little hops, my poor little frozen hops. My cascade vines were up to around 5 feet tall, but now they're all rubbery and sad-looking after a couple of nights of below-freezing temperatures. So I know there are people who are shoveling snow up north who have little to no pity for us here in the south when we, you know, dip our toes into below-freezing temperatures for a couple of nights, but doggone it, the hops are going so well. Ironically, the ones that fared the best were the Kent Goldings, because they're so far behind the others, and they're you know, very close to the ground and easy to cover and protect from the little snow, cold snap. So anyway, in addition to the tragedy of the hops, I've been posting on Twitter when new episodes of the podcasts come out, so you can be among the first to download those shows when you get the notices. And speaking of which, on Basic Brewing Video this week, we take a video tour of the Chalk Brewery in Krebs, Oklahoma. It's a little different. It's more a bit more polished approach to the brewery tour concept. So I'd be interested to see what you think of this week's video podcast. But let's jump into the mailbag, shall we? I've gotten a bunch of letters from listeners following the Science of Skunking episode with Brad Sturgeon. This one comes from Greg in Muncie, Indiana. Greg says, at the end of the show, you mentioned cans as another way to avoid skunking, since they'll stop all light from getting to our beer. I know of a few homebrewers who started using aluminum bottles, the kind that you see occasionally in brands like Bud and Iron City. Not only do those bottles prevent skunking, but they also allow us to take homebrew places where glass isn't allowed, beaches, pools, tailgate parties, etc. Greg says, the downside of aluminum bottles, first, you cannot easily remove the label since it's printed onto the bottle. And second, you'd need a bench capper since the bottles don't have the edge a two-handled capper grabs onto. Well, there you go. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate that. Well, here's another downside that I'm sure you're aware of. You might have to drink some bad beer to get aluminum bottles. Unless you do have a friend or a relative that drinks the beer that comes in the aluminum bottles, and in that case, you can raid their trash can or a recycling bin and get the aluminum bottles out of there. But other than that, I think aluminum bottles are a great concept for being able to take homebrew to the beach or the river or the pool without, you know, the worry of skunking. So I'm wondering if there's a supplier out there who's going to start wholesaling them unlabeled to homebrew shops. That'd be cool. Might be a business opportunity for somebody out there. Phil in Hammond, Indiana, wrote with this. Phil says, being new to homebrewing and a bit of a scientist myself, I found it very interesting when Brad Sturgeon explained the depths which he went to analyze the different bottle types and how they respond to different wavelengths of light. I also found it very interesting that even our hero, the brown bottle, still lets in some wavelengths of light in the red spectrum. It got me wondering, why don't we see completely black bottles? I would think that if we had black bottles, our precious brews, or for our precious brews, we would be blocking out all wavelengths of light. I was wondering if you knew of any brewers that use black bottles for their beers. I don't know about black bottles, but I know that the makers of Delirium Tremens and Delirium Nocturnum, among other beers that they make, use brown bottles, and then they paint them to look like, I guess it's supposed to look like ceramic. So in that case, there would be very little, if any, light getting into that to that beer. And I'm sure there's got to be others out there that use a similar concept. If you'll remember, Brad and I talked in the skunking episode about why some beers like Corona apparently don't get skunked easily, even though they're in colorless glass. I said that I'd heard that some beers used a hop extract that didn't skunk. Well, David from Kalamazoo, Michigan, writes in with some confirmation on that. David says, I just completed the concise course at Siebel, and in the chapter about hops, we learned about reduced hop extracts. These extracts have isoalpha acids, which have been made resistant to light by reducing them chemically. In order to avoid skunking, the beer can only have been made by these reduced types of hop extracts. Use of any regular hops or hop oils will negate the benefit. And David says, also, these reduced isomerized extracts apparently have foam enhancement properties, so there's been a bit of renewed interest in them. So there you go. They weren't a figment of my imagination, these hop extracts. I appreciate that, David. Let's do one more question before we get into our interview. Donovan writes in with this. He says, my question concerns a brew bucket that a friend of mine gave me. This bucket is an official brewing bucket, complete with a strip thermometer. It's definitely been used to make beer, as evidenced by the beer-colored stain on the majority of the surface and the slight but noticeable smell of beer inside the bucket. My question is, was it not washed properly after its last use? Can I wash it and use it again? Well, Donovan, you could, but if it were me, I wouldn't. I've personally got plastic buckets that I've had and used for many years, but they don't have any kind of stain on them at all. Now, what you may be seeing is stain from iodophore, the iodine-based sanitizing product. If you soak equipment too long in iodophore, it can stain some material. So that may be it. And it could be that the bucket's okay. But you know what? Buckets are fairly inexpensive, and I would rather get a new bucket than to risk contaminating a batch of beer in an old bucket that I didn't know the complete history of and didn't have complete control over during its whole lifetime. But that's just my two cents. Get a new bucket and a bit of peace of mind at the same time. Okay, a while back, the folks at the Chalk Brewery in Krebs, Oklahoma, contacted me and invited us over to their brewery to have a tour. They said they'd liked what they saw on our basic brewing video tours and wanted us to come over and give a tour of them. It is the largest brewery in Oklahoma, and Krebs is right next door to McAllister, and it's about 3 hours away. So Steve Wilkes and I loaded up in the Subaru and headed over there. We were treated to a delicious lunch at Pete's Place, which is the Italian restaurant connected to the brewery. And then we took the tour and sat down with Michael Lally, the head brewer.
I mean, it's gonna be the lightest of those.
We're just joining the show already in progress. You hear whenever you hear beers opening, and you don't hear beers pouring, but there are beers pouring. Michael Lally, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
And here also is a familiar voice, Steve Wilkes.
James, it is a joy to be in Krebs, Oklahoma today, sampling these Chalk beers.
And we've just had a wonderful lunch, best lunch I've had in a long time, and a good conversation for the video side of things and a video tour of the brewery that I hope will turn out all right. And we're going to sample your beers and talk about your brewery and talk a bit about your process and how we can brew some beers that are similar. First of all, cheers, gentlemen.
See, I stirred mine up quite a bit more. We got quite a bit of yeast on. I mean, there's quite a bit of yeast in the bottom of the bottle. Mm. So that's what we're shooting for when we put it in the package.
I'll be harvesting this later on.
Now, what are we having?
Well, this is our mainstay, our flagship, I guess, as you will, the Chalk beer. which is the beer we certainly sell the most of. And technically, I mean, it's an unfiltered American wheat beer. But, I mean, it's different. I mean, as we're drinking one, it's different than most American wheat beers, I think.
It's got more body than I would have expected from the wheats that I'm used to drinking. Things that are labeled American wheat beer don't have this much body and mouthfeel.
It's very clean. Yeah. And that's something that I, you know, being from the home brewing side, it's something that I look for immediately. You know, is a beer this light going to be nice and clean and crisp? And it is that. It's a very nice summertime beer.
Right.
Now, this beer has an interesting history. This is, on the bottle it says 1919, and it kind of has a history in the basement, so to speak, doesn't it?
Correct. This is the beer that Pete was brewing illegally during Prohibition and Ford after Prohibition. The Noble Experiment was over that they sold here. It's, you know, as the folklore goes, he was taught how to make by the local Choctaw Indians. So there you go, the name Chalk Beer.
And Pete was the owner of Pete's Place,
correct,
which is the restaurant that the brewery is attached to.
Correct. Correct.
And talk about his history, and talk a bit about the history of how this all started.
Well, as it goes, he comes to America to work, and ends up in Krebs to work in the coal mines, because large coal mining community, large Italian settlement here, came here to basically work slave labor in the coal mines. He gets hurt in a mining accident and can't work, so he tries to parlay his knowledge of Italian food and making illegal beer eventually into a restaurant. And that's how it started. And eventually the family moved upstairs, used the downstairs bedrooms as dining rooms, and it just kind of went from there. And, of course, the thing that's hard to believe is that they continued to brew illegally up until 1982, which it's a great story that our owner, Joe Pritchard, that owns Pete's Place, his father was running the place at the time, which was Bill Pritchard, Pete's son. And Joe said he was in college at OSU, and he picks up the newspaper, and with his cup of coffee, opens up, and there's dad on the front page of the Daily Oklahoman, and there's a big story about illegal beer in Krebs. So it's like, that's when it stopped. So,
and for those not familiar, Krebs is right next door to McAllister, so that'll give you a reference point. And if you're anywhere near driving distance, you need to come. And the food was marvelous today.
Oh, it's some of the best Italian food I've ever had.
Yeah, and that's saying something. Yeah. but tell us about, you were telling us about the original recipe for Chalk Beer.
The original recipe, which we've tried to bring that, the characteristics of that beer to this beer in a modern brewing environment, because it was pretty crude home brewing at best. they would literally take unmilled barley, put it in a pillowcase, and put it in some type of kettle suspended by a broomstick, and boil it like a tea bag, you know, for an hour or what have you. And then they would add the same amount of cane sugar that they had started with barley, and then top that up to the volume they were trying to make, and ferment it with bread yeast.
Do not try this at home.
So there are a lot of characteristics of that beer that we tried to bring to this beer, because it always had a little bit of we wanted it to be a little bit more rustic beer. So that's why, even though we describe this as an unfiltered American style wheat beer, it's a little bit different. It's got a little bit of citrus hops to it, and because theirs was always really fruity because they fermented it so hot.
Yeah.
And it always had a little bit of I don't think sour is a good term, but there's a little bit of a tang to it. So interesting beer, the original anyway. So it was somewhat of a challenge trying to decide how to make it into a modern, because, you know, when we got started in 95, there weren't a bunch of guys making American interpretations of Belgian beers and adding lots of sugars and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you were wanting to be, you know, somewhat, you know, in adherence to the Reinsta Bolt or something. I mean, you know, I mean, that, and that's really the way it was. Nobody wanted to be some kind of adjunct brewer. I mean, trying to put rice or sugar or stuff like that in your product. So that was one of the reasons we started fooling around with adding wheat instead of cane sugar. And that's where we got to the wheat deal to get where we wanted.
Now, have you brewed the original recipe?
We did brew some. We took the original recipe that they used here and brewed some test batches, not on the 7-barrel system that we started with, but we did brew some 10-gallon size batches. And that was pretty wild.
So if you're going to brew an American wheat in this style, what are some hints and tips that you can give us homebrewers?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is how we make this one. We do about a 60-40 2-row to red wheat, and we hop it to about 20 IBUs with Cascade, and we use Y-East American. It's 10-10 is what it is. They're American Hefe. That's that.
Wow. And you say red wheat. Is that I'm not familiar. Is that a malted wheat?
Yep. So you've got either white wheat or red wheat. So we use red.
And that's where the color comes from.
Well, maybe so. I mean, you get a lot of it from the yeast, too, because, I mean, look how mine appears a lot darker than those. So that's some of it as well. You know, we used to – this is another funny brewing story. We won a medal at the Great American Beer Festival in 2000 with this beer. We won a bronze in the American Hefe category. And Brees had somehow, for some reason, had accidentally sent me a sack of 120L caramel malt. Actually, I think he sent me two or three sacks. And I called him and I said, hey, this is not what I ordered. He said, well, if you don't send it back. I mean, it costs more to do that. Just use it. Mm. What am I going to use this stuff for? So we were brewing chalk, and I took a 1-gallon pitcher, scooped it into that sack of 120L, and poured it in the mill. I thought, I'll just use a scoop of this in every batch till it's gone. Better than throwing it away. And then we won a medal at the Great American Beer Festival. So it was like one of those sports superstitions. I mean, forever we did that just because we didn't know if it mattered or not. But by God, we'd won a medal with it. So we finally gave that up on the new system. So I don't know. I don't know if it was magic or not, but we did it.
It's just that little added complexity. Steve was careful in decanting ours, and we don't get nearly the cloudiness. Is there any bit of the any
this one's
pretty hit me with a little bit of the dregs there, and that can the yeast can really change the character of a wheat beer.
And you see from just that right there that we are pretty judicious with the amount of yeast that ends up in the package, and that seems to be just part of the way we do it.
Oh, man, that made a world of difference.
It really did. It
whereas
beer up a lot.
Whereas before it was just very, very clean. Now we get the nice yeasty characters, and it really.
I'm not sure if it's yeast bite, but you could say that, I guess. But it's totally different. You know, and this is in the bottle, and we'll talk about this on the next beer. That's been one of the challenges to making a good white beer. We store the kegs upside down. And ship the kegs upside down. So hopefully, once it gets to the bar or the restaurant, or whatever, you got it. It gets served somewhat like this because that's what we're shooting for.
Wow! And you also can this beer.
We do can this beer. As far as we know, it's the only can-ditioned beer in the United States for sure. As far as we know,
can-ditioned.
Right.
And you borrowed that term from Dale Kateches of Oscar Blues.
Dale coined the term. I'm sure it's not the only phrase he's coined, but it was a good one. Because when we first canned the chalk, just something was missing. And it, you know, it took us a little bit to figure out what it was. And, of course, it's because we bottle condition every product, and we were artificially carbonating the chalk and then putting it in a can. It just didn't work. Mm. So we thought, well, we'll condition it. and it worked. I tell you the truth, it's you know, we're going to see more and more of it. I wish we could get away with it here, but the can's a great package for beer. I actually like the chalk is probably better out of the cans. It really is. But it's hard, I guess, for people to make the switch. That it's got such a stigma about canned beer.
Well, there's trying to be in the premium beer market, and then you got Dale's the only one that seems to be able to make it work.
Well, there is 0% chance of skunking your beer,
right,
if it's in a can.
Totally UV protected. Yeah, it's great.
Now, we didn't talk about fermentation temperature. What kind of fermentation temperature?
We ferment all the ales here at 68, except for the Belgians now, and we'll get on that on the next beer. But, I mean, you know, and it just depends. I mean, you know how it is. You read something, you research something, and then you do something. We ferment that one. We ferment it as hot as we possibly can without getting the beer blowing out the top of the fermenter because we think that particular yeast – fares better the warmer we can keep it.
We were talking about the next one. Shall we move on to the next one?
Beer. Just to kind of tell you what this one's all about. I mean, this is as far as yeast. This is Y-East, Belgian white beer yeast. We do a protein rest. It's got flaked barley, and we ferment it warm. And we use coriander and chamomile. We try to carbonate it really well. So you need a bigger glass, really, don't you? Because it's got so much carbonation.
Well, Steve has been criticized for his pouring style.
Well, I tell you something. This is a challenge when you bottle condition, because, we're even though we'd like to fancy ourselves as knowing what we're doing, the batch size varies. Just because you get a better boil third or fourth batch into the week than you do the first day. So your volume ends up being a little bit lower or higher at different times. Well, you're priming against a known volume. Mm-hmm. So every once in a while you'll have a little more priming sugar than you do typically the same amount of beer. So sometimes – and that's okay if it's this beer. It's not so great if it's like the black lager.
Right.
So, but, you know.
Yeah, this is the waving wheat. And a Belgian style wheat, and it's got quite a bit of. Or yours has more carbonation than mine. I'm holding them.
Pour right there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's like a. It's like
I'm
like
doing
a
it for TV.
Yeah. It's like a like a frosted or a malted milkshake on the top there.
But I mean, and this is one of the things that we got into when I was trying because I really like white beers. There's a lot of great ones out there, but you got what are you going to do? You don't want to clone Hoegaarden or something,
right?
Because that's already on the shelf. And there's some good ones out there. So how do you do it a little bit different? And that's why we're using the chamomile, as well as the coriander. And we've been experimenting with some other citrus too besides orange. I'm not 100% sure I'm going to stay with that.
Mm-hmm.
We've experimented with using some other stuff.
So how much? How much chamomile would go into a batch, and can you even begin to translate that down to what a home brewer might use?
Yeah, it probably could. It's not as much as you think. Do you get it in that? Can you?
I do. A little bit, yeah.
Because it's only about 300 grams in 15 barrels. So if you want to try to knock that down to 5 gallons, that's crazy. It's not as much as you would think. And see, that's where we were, because you hear that. Don't get crazy with the spices.
Right.
So we were really careful on the first batch, and it was like, are there spices in this? That was batch number one. We drank that one. And we progressively ramped them up a little bit after the first one until we got to this. And I'm pretty happy with this. It's not too much either way.
Mm-hmm.
I think I am. I'm fixing to taste it.
Yeah, there's – I mean, my palate is not trained very well, but it is a spicier Belgian wheat than I'm used to, but I like it. It's got maybe a little bit of a softer, like a vanilla. Do you get like a vanilla flavor as well?
Well, see, I think that's the chamomile. I mean, yeah. If you ever just drink chamomile tea,
right?
It's a real soft, easy flavor in your mouth, and that's what I get from this. I don't get a lot of bite. I don't get a lot of coriander bite. So
people get pretty crazy with the coriander, and sometimes I like that. The other thing that we tried to do too is I thought it was important. I mean, I'm not trying to make an IPA white beer, but I thought it was important that there be some. I thought it was important to be some bitterness there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think if you hunt for it, there's some little bit of bitterness there to kind of offset. But you know how the other thing that we tried to work towards was number one, getting it to stay cloudy, mm-hmm. which has been a challenge, because this yeast wants to, man, it wants to be clear.
Huh. And remind us of the kind of ingredient profile that we're looking at.
Yeah. This is Weiss Bavarian. I mean, Belgian white. I don't even know what the number is. Is that great or what? Of course. So you're looking at two row. Again, you're looking at red wheat. You're looking at flaked wheat, and that's it. It's just two row and wheat, and we do a protein rest on a small portion of the two row and all the flaked wheat. We mash in again right on top of that with the rest of the grain bill, because we found that trying to do a protein rest on the whole mash is a recipe for disaster in our setup with highly modified American malt.
Yeah, talk about that. You said you didn't want to do the whole thing. So talk about in detail. How do you approach that?
Well, we did it on the first couple batches, and what that entailed was, you know, 900 pounds of mashing in and hitting 122 with 900 pounds, and then turning the steam on and stirring 900 pounds until you got to the next step. That was hard. So we didn't like that. So then we decided, well, we'll do two separate mashes, and then trying to figure out the ratio of water on a very small mash. It took us a couple of tries to do it. We finally got it. But it's easy. I mean, and that's the other thing. If it was a one-off beer that we were just doing a couple of times a year, it wouldn't matter if it was really hard. But this is the number two seller. This is the second best seller we got. So we brew a lot of it. So, I mean, it can't be that difficult in order to make it, you know, work. Because we like to be able to knock out two batches in 10 hours. And if it can't fit in those parameters, then we have a hard time making it happen.
So you do a second smaller mash with just enough two row to give you the enzymatic power to do the conversion.
You got it. And then after we do the protein rest there, we'll just dump the whole rest of the mash in right on top of that, and then go from there. And you know, we've worked at it enough where by the time we mash in the second mash on top of it, we're at the next rest temperature. And that was another thing, because you don't really have to have that much malt to do the protein rest, just enough for, like you said, have enough enzymatic power to knock out the flaked wheat. And then, you know, hitting the next step wasn't very hard. The first couple ones were really tough, though. My guys were like, wow, that's a lot of stirring. And I said, here's what I said. I said, you got to suffer for a good white beer. You got to suffer. There's a lot of good ones out there.
Now, call me crazy, but take a taste of that and think carrot cake.
I always think carrot cake. what are you talking about?
It's always time for
carrot cake. It's always time for carrot cake. Yeah.
I mean, it's not as heavy as carrot cake, but so there's some of those spice notes that are in carrot cake that are in this white beer.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the other good, and not necessarily about this white beer. I'm not sitting here, you know, beating my chest about mine because we're drinking it. But I think that's another great thing about a white beer. And I think that's why it has a good appeal to regular beer drinkers and professional beer tasters like ourselves, is that after you pour it and it sits there and it warms up a little bit, throughout the course of the whole beer, you really pick up a lot of different flavors there. Not just a little bit of funkiness from the yeast. Like I said, I get a little hops out of ours, and then you start picking out the different spices. And I tell you something that was important to us, and that was the reason we fought that protein rest till we figured it out, is to me, a white beer has got to have that weird feeling on your tongue. It's almost like, you know, in the hot summer when you drink a Coke, And your whole mouth is like you couldn't spit if you wanted to. You know what I mean? It's just that weird coating in your mouth. I think a white beer has somewhat of that kind of effect on your tongue. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get that, or am I just? Should I not?
Yeah, no, I think it's a creamy. It's a creamy that may lend itself to the carrot cake thing. You know, because carrot cake has the cream cheese icing on it.
Right.
But again, the fermentation temperature on this. You let it run wild.
What we do is we'll pitch it. We'll pitch the yeast in there, and we'll run the beer in our regular. You know, we run all the beers in the tank at about, you know, 66 to 68, and we'll let it sit in the tank for the first 24 hours at 68, and then we'll just turn the glycol off. and just let it go. I haven't seen it get over 72, but if you shut it off sooner than that, I mean, you'll just be blowing yeast out on the floor, and that's not very much fun. I'm sure everybody's experienced that, but it's not much fun. It's not much fun here. And then the other thing that you get into here is that whole mentality of having a Belgian yeast gone wild in the brewery. Yeah. So the first time I came in the brewery, and I saw that I came in the door, and BJ, our brewer, and he had the look of horror on his face. I had no idea what was going on.
It's gotten out.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is yeast all over the floor because it's blowing out of the top of the tank, and I'm thinking, wow, it's just contamination. Yeah. You know,
now,
I mean,
all our beers are Belgian.
Now we're a Belgian brewery.
So that was kind of a scary thing, really.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think that's hard about doing this beer for us is that's the only yeast – this beer gets used in this beer, and that's it. So you're having to maintain a yeast strain for one beer. Now, we've kind of switched around the pale ale to help out with, because the Minor Mishap's a lager. We're using that lager yeast in the pale ale as well, so that helps us always have plenty of it going. But I can't figure out what I can use this in to have another beer going. Actually, we did do a kind of Belgian-style blonde with this yeast, just so we could see if it might be something we could do. And
I would encourage more Belgian beers.
I agree. I agree. And you know something? The funny thing is, and it's kind of one of those things where we've experienced this too. I mean, an unfiltered wheat beer you can sell to it's really kind of the middle of the road beer. People that don't know anything about beer or people that like beer, it's hard to believe that people that aren't really beer people will drink something that looks like that. But it's unbelievable how people will embrace an unfiltered beer, and the Belgians seem to be pretty good universal appeal. Whereas the hoppy beers, people either love them, or it's, have you seen that look?
Yeah.
People drink, and it's like, wow, how can I get rid of this?
Yeah, like one of my relatives said, ooh, what is that flavor?
Yeah.
I said, it's flavor.
That's what I tell people. It's got that microbrewed flavor. Yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, let's move on to the hoppy beer. It's called Basement Batch, the pale ale. And pretty much if you are a small brewery, is it a requirement to an American small brewery? Is it pretty much a requirement to make a hoppy beer nowadays?
I think it probably is, and I think that a lot of the other guys that are out there making hoppy beers have set the bar high for you if it wasn't originally part of your lineup. And that's another thing as far as putting a pale ale out on the shelf. For me personally, and you know, I mean, It's hard to get behind something you don't really like, your own personal self. So one of the things I don't like about hoppy beers is ones that are way over-carbonated. So we are intentionally – this is intentionally – I mean, it's still got a nice head on it, but this is not near the carbonation level of this white beer.
No. This is very nice. I like this beer.
So very simple. It's very, very, very simple grain bill. Again, we're using the lager yeast on this. However, we're fermenting it at about 64 degrees with the S23, the ferment, the dry lager yeast. This is mainly 2-row. It's got some Victory, some 10L, and some 40L, and it's hopped with Cascade, German Perlée, and a pretty good dose of Centennial in the Whirlpool.
So what would you call that? A copper color?
Yeah, I would definitely say that's probably red. Is that red?
That's pretty red. You know, I'll tell you what this reminds me of. It reminds me of just British bitters pulled from a beer engine in London.
Oh.
And maybe it's just the carbonation level.
I think the carbonation level, to me, is important.
Yeah.
Because I think a pale ale that's real gassy, I think it kind of – you get a different kind of bitterness, really, from high carbonation level, and you don't get – and you know what? When we were using the 1010, the American Hefe yeast on this beer, I couldn't taste the any of the caramel malts, their Victory, and I couldn't taste the hops. So that was money thrown away as far as ingredients. So you could have been using anything. It wouldn't have mattered. You couldn't taste it. So that was another reason we felt like pulling the carbonation level back because, I mean, really, a guy that's going to buy a pale ale – is a beer person. So he's not going to go, wow, that's – I mean, he's going to understand what's going on there, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's my take on it. But the little bit more softer on the palate with less carbonation, I think we're getting our money's worth out of the ingredients.
I completely agree with that. I really like this idea. And I mean, so much so that I'm thinking, how do I do this at home? And I'm assuming that I just pitch with a little less sugar.
Yeah, exactly. I can actually tell you what the ratio for 5 gallons on this is. It's because that's how we figure it. We're using in this, that is half a cup per 5 gallons.
Okay.
And, of course, this is filtered, and we're adding – actually, we use the – what do they call it? US05? Is that the dry 1056?
US05. It used to be US56, but now it's US05.
We're using 1 gram per barrel of dry yeast that we pitch back onto the beer with half a cup of dextrose per 5 gallons. There's the secret bottle conditioning formula.
Well, it is a real ale. I mean, you talk about, you know, the British campaign for real ale, since this is bottle conditioned.
I guess that certainly would constitute as real ale, would it? I never even thought of it.
Yeah, now you can. Yeah. No charge for that marketing speak. No, it is. You know, we had a show on real ale and on cask conditioning, and our guest brought up that we are making, as homebrewers, if we are bottle conditioning, we are making real ale, right? Because it is conditioned in the bottle that is naturally carbonated.
Well, one of the other things that I like about this is, and I know it's because of the recipe, not because, is that kind of citrusy sweetness it's got is all that Centennial. Because we use a pretty good dose of it just in the whirlpool, because, I mean, what I'm trying to get a really good hoppy nose on it. I mean, it's getting there, but this is the one we've worked the hardest at. We literally, every other time we brewed this last year, we did something different. Just because we just couldn't get there. And like I said before, we felt like if you're going to put a pale ale on the shelf with those other dozen that are sitting there that are really good beers,
right,
then there's got to be something. You know. And I'm not sure if – I think pale ale tells me something about the flavor, not the color.
Mm. Yeah.
Even though that might be pushing it. I don't know.
Well, this is definitely a different beer. I mean, the IPAs and the pale ales that are out there, and I won't name brands, but they're all very similar. And this is very different, although it's definitely a pale ale. This is a different beer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that this may go, but I mean, it doesn't just attack you with bitterness, and it doesn't just attack you with the hops, which may be a turnoff to some of the homebrewers out there who are used to huge hoppy beers. Right. But there's something to be said for balance, I think this is a well balanced beer.
We have had the IBU level up a little bit higher than this particular one before, but then I felt like we were probably pushing the low end boundaries of an American IPA, and then I felt like that more so than color was getting me out of the style parameters.
Yeah,
I'd say because I think if you get a pale ale over 50. I mean, I'm not sure what's the low end for an American IPA.
I don't know. I'm not a style guy.
Yeah, but it's got to be close to that.
Yeah.
Now talk about your hopping schedule again. You said the Centennial in the whirlpool, but through the boil, what's your hopping schedule?
Well, like? we use the German Pearly for the kettle hop on this, because we use a lot of that in the other beers, and I mean, you know, you get. It's pretty neutral, and it's a pretty decent alpha acid. I mean, I think the stuff we're using now is 7 or 7.5. And then we use some Cascade about a 15-minute before the flame out addition, and then we use about a 50-50 blend of Cascade and Centennial in the whirlpool. You know, I think the big whirlpool addition on a pale ale or an IPA is pretty important. I mean, I'm not so sure I'm really getting anything out of that 15-minute before flame-out addition, you know, because – and I mean, I know you guys have probably either had some or made some of those hot burst kind of beers where you know, just a little bit of bitter in the kettle and then put an unbelievable amount of hops on the back end. I think those are great.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you're going to use a bunch of hops, put them where they taste the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've done batches of extract beer where we've only boiled for 15 minutes and just used twice the amount of bitterness hops, but then added them at 15 minutes before the end of the boil, which is the start of the boil,
right,
and just moved, you know, all the hops to the end and just up the amount. And you get similar bitterness with lots more
right
flavor and aroma.
I tell you what was hard for us to calculate on this, and it's that when you dump a bunch of hops in a whirlpool, and then it takes an hour and 15 minutes for you to run the beer from the kettle to the fermenter because you got to cool it down on the way. Mm-hmm. You pick up some IBUs there, so trying to figure out how much you were getting there was a challenge. Because we knew we just didn't know how much. And then when you're trying to make it hoppy on purpose, it's like, well, where are we at here? So, yeah, you know, it, kind of the way we figured it out was kind of crazy because we figured it out on the chalk, because what we'd do is we would put the hops in a different place and send the beer to the lab and test it, because we had a beer we brewed a lot, so we knew what we should have been getting. So we adjusted our spreadsheet for those different additions as far as how much, you know, utilization we're getting.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, if you're a home brewer as well as a professional brewer, we were talking to BJ in the brew house, and he was running the beer through the heat exchange unit.
Right.
And he was saying, you know, it's really interesting, depending on – Steve was asking, well, how long does it take to run it through the heat exchange unit? And he said, well, it depends on the time of year and the
right
temperature of the groundwater. If you've added hops in the whirlpool, whether you're a home brewer or a professional brewer, and it's taking you twice, three times as long – if it's the summertime to cool down your wort, then you're going to get a different beer than if you're doing it in the wintertime and it takes you 15 minutes.
Got it. So you're going to get some more bitterness instead of aroma out of that hop, mm-hmm, that hop load. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to figure that one out. So,
well, let's go on to the last one, and it's called Minor Mishap, and your marketing guys have come up with an interesting — an interesting strategy on the naming of these beers, because they kind of follow the life of the founder, Pete. And so we have the Minor Mishap, which is so far the last beer in the series, but there's one more. You're going to wind up with six beers in the series. So tell us about this. Is this Minor Mishap?
Well, the Minor Mishap has been kind of a fun project. I mean, it's the only lager that we do in our year-round lineup, and the recipe came from a homebrewer friend of ours. His name is Sean Scott. He had this recipe that we loved, and we thought it would really be cool to brew it here. So we scaled up a 5-gallon recipe, brewed it. Originally brewed it the first time on the 7-barrel system, so it's been several years ago. And we really enjoyed it. We drank it, and we would sample people on it because, I mean, it's dark, mm-hmm, but deceiving in its taste.
And this is a black lager, right?
Right.
So and the aroma, mm-hmm, boy, those dark grains really do make an impact.
But when you taste it, you don't get that sharp kind of dark malt bite. There's a different kind of,
oh wow,
flavor in there.
It's a very tasty beer.
Yeah. Here again, we've kind of gone shied away from the overcarbonation of the product there, because with a beer, a dark beer like that, you a whole different kind of mouthfeel. But we do that in a couple different ways. I mean, and like I said, this was all Scotty's idea. I mean, it was his recipe, so we wanted to follow it the way he brewed it at home. So the first time we brewed it, we milled everything in except for we milled the carafa, because it's all Weihrauch malt. We used Weihrauch Pilsner, Weihrauch Munich Type 2, a Weihrauch Kara Munich. Actually, it's got some Gambrinus honey malt, and it's got the Weihrauch Kara Munich, Carafa 1. So we brewed that. We milled the Carafa 1 first, and we put it back in the sack. So then we mash in. And right before we start to sparge, we dump that dark malt on the top of the mash, and just and we've tried it both ways, because I was a naysayer. I was like, I'm not buying this, but he was right, and that's okay. I've been wrong plenty of times.
So the strategy is that you get the color from the dark malt, but you don't get the biting astringency.
Some of the flavor too, but yeah, you don't get that bite.
Yeah,
you don't get that kind of like that. Well, I mean, even a lot of Black Patent kind of has it, but certainly roasted barley, it gives you that kind of, you know. So
the burnt flavor, you're not getting the burnt flavor out of this,
right?
This, yeah, you just get the nice roastiness without it. It's very light, and it's at the front of the beer. It's not at the back of the beer. I don't have any kind of bitterness, mm-hmm. you know, in my mouth after I'm done with it. So it's very enjoyable. And I like the lighter carbonation. Again, it's like it invites me to drink more than one.
Well, I tell you, that's something that we learned the hard way. For whatever reason, and this is a new beer we just came out with in December of 07. The first couple batches were kind of like that white beer. It was like, whoa. I mean, you know, it was really gassy. For whatever reason, this particular beer, even carbonated at the same level as another beer, seems way more carbonated. There's something about the body of this. I mean, we even find it when we're bottling the beer. Whenever we bottle this, it foams a lot more in the filler, even when it's flat.
Huh.
So there's something there. So we worked a little bit harder to try to get it. Because, I mean, I'm telling you, the first couple of batches were like, wow, it looks like a Belgian black ale. It's got a big weird head, and it's the carbonation, you know, the head's that deep. It's like, okay, that's not going to work.
Well, it's nice and clean because it's a lager.
Yeah.
And you're using, again, the
that's 23 dry lager yeast.
Yeah, the it's marketed, I guess, for homebrewers as Saftlager.
Right.
Right. So right. It's something that, you know, that we can get. It's, and, it, you know, the dry is easier to work with if you're doing lagers than a liquid yeast, because you don't have to make that giant starter. You just add twice as many packs.
Right. Well, actually, you know, they make 500 gram packs that we use in the fermenters. But as far as using those dry yeast to bottle condition with, I buy cases of those packs like you would in the homebrew store, because we don't have to measure it.
Huh.
I mean, it's just a more sanitary way to use it. You just cut it open and hydrate it and put it in the tank.
Wow.
So it's just an easier way for us to deal with it, and just one less contamination point, you know. So.
Well, it's very nice, very nice and clean.
People usually think that's funny. It's like, oh. Wow, are you kidding me?
Well, no, you know, I'm not.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
No, that's very nice. It's roasty, and you know, there's some little coffee notes, a little bit of chocolate notes in the nose, and but it's very clean and very roasty without being astringent like you might find. It's just a nice clean
beer.
It's not
what people expect when they see it. It's
you expect it to be, you know, really bitter, a big stout, mm-hmm. you know, with a kind of a burnt thing going on, and it's not there.
You know, I would like to blindfold some of these people that say, oh, I just don't like dark beers, you know, and just say, taste this and see what you think.
And yeah, actually, we don't filter this either, so that's even unfiltered.
Well, it's pretty dark. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it. Well, no, it's got red, it's really ruby good. Red hues.
Yeah.
I guess
it's a red, a deep red beer,
but delicious.
But that's the new one. So we're still working on it. We're still working on that one a little bit, just kind of tweaking it here and there. More of just a process thing than, you know, trying to find a balance of carbonation and that kind of things.
And there are some other odd batches that in larger bottles that you guys are playing with. I had the privilege of trying your Beer de Garde, which is very nice, you know, again, from being a Belgian fan. And you've done a Saison in the past. And
you know, and there was a reason we did those. I mean, when we got the brew something you want to brew call, I mean, we thought it would be fun. I mean, because the way we feel, I mean, Chalk is kind of an indigenous beer of this area, unfiltered indigenous beer to this area. So we thought, you know, it'd be cool to brew something that's the Chalk beer of other parts of the world. So it just so happened that, I mean, you know, I'm just like you guys. I've got all the Brewers Association books, and I was reading Farmhouse Ales at the time. Mm-hmm. So we thought it would be cool to do a Beer de Garde and a Saison. So we did, because a lot of the Beer de Gardes and the Saisons are a little bit more tamer these days. So we thought it would be cool to kind of do them, you know, in a different way. Because, you know, a lot of guys use just a lager yeast in a Beer de Garde, so you don't get a lot of that Belgian characteristics, and we didn't do that.
Yeah, it had a nice Belgian character. Yeah.
So, and it, we actually filtered that one, but we didn't filter the Saison. We did that draft only, and it went real well, too.
Well, this has been fun, and I wish we had more time. Is there one last question that you want to ask, Steve? I'm giving you one more opportunity to ask the brewer of the largest brewery in Oklahoma, right? So, your turn, Steve.
Where can we buy your beers?
Well, I mean, we're statewide in Oklahoma, and you can buy them in Northwest Arkansas.
Yay!
And we're in the kind of the Wichita market in Kansas, and we're working on a couple other states right now. But right now, that's where we're at.
Well, excellent. We look forward to wider distribution and more beers coming from you. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks again to Michael Lally and the fine folks at Chalk Beer and Pete's Place for the hospitality. And we wish them the best as they grow in this part of the country. And you can learn more at chalkbeer.com. That's chocbeer.com. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And check out our low-tech lagering decoction mashing DVD on basicbrewing.com, where you can see Steve Wilkes do a single-step decoction mash, and you can follow me through a lager fermentation in the middle of summer here in Northwest Arkansas, where I don't use a dedicated chest freezer. There also are original DVDs in Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing. We walk you through the extract brewing process step-by-step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing, Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all-grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. And we tell you about batch sparging, fly sparging, and infusion mashing and step mashing, all in a non-linear way that you can navigate around in there. We got new combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can see the growing listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We got shirts and hats, including our ever-popular Go Forth and Flocculate shirt. And also, thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Logitech QuickCam Pro 9000 and the Sleep Easy Solution. The Exhausted Parent's Guide to Getting Your Child to Sleep from Birth to Age 5. Wow, I remember those days. Lots of baby stuff coming through the Amazon link. I appreciate that. Appreciate all the stuff, non-baby stuff and everything. I appreciate the support. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support there. We appreciate your support in all ways, all the ways that you support this podcast, from just spreading the word to other brewers that you know, to writing us email, to buying our stuff, and what have you. It's a great thing. I'm getting all misty-eyed. That's all. Until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.